So this morning in our sutra service, we read a portion of a letter that Zen Master Da Hui wrote to me. He wrote it around the 12th century, knowing that I would be here waiting to receive his teaching. And of course, all of these teachings are love letters from our ancestors. These teachings are not for someone else. So as we chant, as you read through the sutra book, as we hear these teachings, we say we lock eyebrows with the ancestors, that in truth these teachings are for you, and you hear the teachings that are for you. Sometimes we say that the best way to listen to a Dharma talk is to imagine that you and I are the only two people in the room. And that this talk is just for you. And when we listen in this way to a Dharma talk, when we receive our life in this way, we are touched that the world and the self meet. And in this meeting, there is nothing left out. All the Buddhas and ancestors, and all those who come after us, are all right here. There is no Buddha outside to encounter. There is no Buddha inside to find. Just this moment, and Da Hui, a great Rinzai, a Linji Zen master in China, born in the late 11th century. He was a great teacher and was one of the well-known in his time in the Song Dynasty when Zen was quite the thing. People in high places thought Zen was a good idea. And we might think how wonderful that was. We might wish that our current day politicians were Zen adherents. But apparently this did not stop people from being people. And it was a time in the Song Dynasty of great unrest. And actually at one point, Da Hui was banished. He was stripped of his titles and disgraced. Spent 15 years in Worcester, Mass. before he was invited back to Washington, D.C. But he was eventually reinstated. I paired this reading, which we're entitling Observing the One Who is Dim and Dull, with a reading from Hongzhi, the one that began, "All dharmas are innately amazing." And Hongzhi was a Soto master in China. And they were contemporaries. And in some accounts, they were dueling schools of Zen, and Da Hui wrote some very disparaging things about Hongzhi and his dharma, clearly inferior dharma. But apparently also they were great dharma brothers, and when Da Hui died, when Hongzhi died, he told his students to go study with Da Hui. So in the Zen tradition we have these great streams, the Rinzai and Soto, we often call them. Rinzai often seen as the wisdom sword cutting through delusion, the giving everything and not holding back. And the Soto side being the appreciation that it's already here. And I think most helpful not to see these as two separate schools. Of course, in our Boundless Way school, my lineage is through the Rinzai, this Linji tradition, and Melissa and Steve through the Soto tradition, which also runs through me. But anyway, there is this blending, and we need both aspects of our practice, both this great determination and this willingness to go to whatever lengths it requires, this great spirit of practice, and also entering into this place of remembering again and again that there is nowhere to go and nothing to accomplish. It is already fully revealed. So this reading is an excerpt from a letter that Dawi wrote to one of his students. And I'll just read the beginning. It says, "You may imagine that your root nature is dim and dull, and you may imagine that although you make efforts to cultivate and uphold the Dharma, you've never gotten an instant of transcendent enlightenment. Yet the one who can recognize dim and dull is definitely not dim and dull. After all, where else would you seek transcendent enlightenment? People who study this path must depend on their dimness and dullness to enter." Oftentimes we may read about qualities necessary to be a good Zen practitioner and think that we may be deficient in them. But I think maybe most of us can stand firm in our dimness and dullness and hope that we have enough dimness and dullness to find our way. But this wonderful encouragement, clearly this student, who these are letters to lay practitioners like you and me, this student has written to the teacher, to Dawi, and said, "Please help me. I'm not smart and clear. I don't have a wisdom eye. I myself really don't get it." And you talk about enlightenment, and I have no idea what you're talking about. I wish I had that. But clearly I don't. And Dawi writes back so lovingly, acknowledging, reflecting back, "You say you are dim and dull. You say that you have never had a moment of transcendent enlightenment." And just to pause and talk about transcendent enlightenment, and in this on this path of Zen, we say there is something that can be called transcendent enlightenment. There is the possibility of waking up and knowing for ourselves. But this experience of awakening or enlightenment, I think, has been quite oversold by the tradition and by our culture. And so we make it into a thing. And certainly we can read stories of students of the past, their encounter with teacher, and the teacher says something, and then the student has transcendent enlightenment and lives happily ever after. And we can easily fall into the trap of waiting and hoping that maybe someday it will happen for us. And this notion of enlightenment is actually quite a problem. Later on he says, those with commonplace understanding often take the intention of seeking transcendent enlightenment and make it into an obstacle set before them, so their own correct understanding cannot appear. So we hear enlightenment, awakening, and we take that and make it into a problem. Maybe this might be some definition of being human. The animals that make everything into a problem. We have this unlimited creativity and capacity to make it into a problem. And we make enlightenment into a problem when we imagine it somewhere else. And we put ourselves on the little timeline. You know, first I went to kindergarten, and then I graduated from college. Then I discovered Zen, and enlightenment is someplace, maybe tonight, maybe at the end of retreat, maybe three more retreats. Many of us, I have our secret plan for awakening, and we enact, this is Barry Magid said, the secret practice. And part of the wonderful thing of coming on retreat is that these fantasies become very painful, that we can begin to wear them down. And any idea you have about awakening is just an idea you have about awakening. Meanwhile, while you are busy trying to find your head, all the time, already sitting firmly between your shoulders. And Dawi refers to this where he says, the one who can recognize dim and dull is definitely not dim and dull. So these stories arise, and the stories we cling to most certainly are the stories about who we are. Yesterday, Mike Fiedelicki talked about the passage saying that your ideas about good practice and bad practice are of no value. Similarly, your opinion about yourself is just an opinion. And in some way, every opinion is true. Everything contains some truth. But this reality that we encounter, this reality that we are studying, cannot be bound in containers. This life is boundless, boundlessly living itself. One of my great sources of comfort is a poem that I learned when I was in my early 20s. And it's a Native American song, apparently. And it says, why do I go about pitying myself when all the time I am being carried by great winds across the sky? Why do I go about pitying myself while all the time I am being carried on great winds across the sky? We've spoken earlier of these great winds, this effortless functioning. Steve spoke the other day of this intelligence of the body, knowing what to do, that we can say that we are maintaining our life, but only in the narrowest sense. We might more correctly say that we are allowed to live. that life is passing through us. Life is giving itself to us. Life is giving ourself to us. And whether you know it or not, whether you are thinking about your heart, whether you are aware of your breath, it is taking care of you. And has taken care of you from your very first yelp when you came out into this bright and terrifying world. This great wind of life that comes to us as such a precious and such a terrifying gift. And here in our practice we are trying to clarify this matter. We are learning to appreciate our life. And part of appreciating is slowing down. We are naturally looking here and looking there. Looking everywhere else, we are off to the races before the gun sounds. And we search everywhere, search high and low. Where is my self nature? Like going into a dark room with a flashlight and looking everywhere for the flashlight. The beam shines here. No, not in that corner. Up on the ceiling and the wall underneath the carpet. Where is the light? Where is this flashlight? And all the time, this great awakening is our birthright. The sense, the feeling of the foot on the floor as we walk, the boundless flow of thoughts, these arisings moment after moment arising out of the great vastness, some particular thought, some particular emotion or sensation, everything coming unbidden and everything vanishing. This life and death is not some other place, but moment after moment, instant after instant. I think Dogen said 72,000 times a second, this flashing into being and this disappearing. And we catch a couple dots. We catch four dots out of 10 million and we say, oh, look, it's the big bear. And then we make up our stories about the big bear and we run after the big bear and we run away from the big bear. And all the time, this world is giving itself, is expressing itself, irrepressible, cannot stop, cannot start. And Dawi saying, so this perception itself is the manifestation of the Dharma, this sense of even knowing that you are carried away by the story, by the opinion, by the sensation. This is awakening. There is an awareness that cannot be studied by awareness. You cannot stand outside of this and operate on it. There is no place to stand. There is no one standing. There is just this great arising, this great shout of life, this great dance, this wondrous, irrepressible dance. And so we might think that we cannot come, that we have not been invited to the dance. or we may find all kinds of reasons why we are unworthy. And in this lovely, lovely love song to Dim and Dull, is really encouraging us to use this moment. We've spoken a couple times about the three poisons: greed, anger, and ignorance. All of us, tend to specialize in one. All of us have great capacity in all three of these. But myself, I have made a great study of ignorance. And appears many ways. We've talked about delusive certainty, and certainly I've done a couple courses in that. But more of my time has been in the fog. When things are really difficult, I get foggy and sort of space out. And as I began my path of Zen through much of it, this foggy state would arise, and I would struggle as mightily as I could, because clearly fog is bad. Muddle is bad. Dimness is bad. Dullness is bad. I wanted energetic clarity. And for yourself, you can perhaps notice what are the mind states that arise that are most troublesome for you. The ones you judge most clearly the problem. Someone mentioned the other day of coming up to Doksan in a difficult place, and the teacher says, yes, you're in a difficult place. And then bows and rings the bell. This is a wonderful teaching. These states, and especially the states that we resist. I think he focuses on dimness and dullness because so clearly to the person writing this, this is his problem. And you come to the Zen teacher and you bring your problem. Here's the problem with me. I'm too judgmental. I'm too emotional. I'm too cold. And the work of our practice is to be transformed. Whoever you are, it's all you've got. You may wish to be someone else. And certainly I think all of us do. For me, quite clear sometimes that I am inadequate. I should be more something else. But at some point, we give up. We talked about this surrender. The only thing you have to work with is yourself, as you are. You will not have more of something else later. So whatever this place, that this couldn't be it, is the entry place. This pain, this vulnerability, this weakness, this confusion, this anger, this joy, this clarity, this spaciousness, this is your only resource. So these places of weakness are essential to our practice. One other teacher, Moshe Feldenkrais, not a Zen teacher, but so important that this enterprise we are engaged in is not a brand name, in that the wisdom of Zen is not the wisdom of Zen, but is a presentation of life itself. And I hope we continue to fight against sectarianism and thinking that somehow we own what it means to be human, so that we can appreciate expressions of truth and teachings from everywhere. So Moshe Feldenkrais wrote, "Find your true weakness and surrender to it. Therein lies the path to genius. Most people spend their lives using their strengths to overcome or cover up their weaknesses. Those few who use their strengths to incorporate their weaknesses, who don't divide themselves, those people are very rare. Those few who use their strengths to incorporate their weaknesses, who don't divide themselves, those people are very rare. In any generation, there are a few, and they lead their generation." So we are called, each one of us, to lead our generation, to use our strength and to use our practice to save all beings, to save every self that arises. Every self that arises is the Buddha appearing to us in the form of. Dimness and dullness, anger and reactivity, coldness and aloneness. We have all been blessed beyond measure to be alive, to be alive in the middle of it all. And closes with saying, don't seek transcendent enlightenment. Just observe and observe. Suddenly, you'll laugh out loud. Beyond this, there is nothing that can be said. Thank you. So invite you to sit comfortably. And come forward with your dimness and dullness, with your wisdom, whatever is arising for you about this enterprise. Yeah.
I'm definitely feeling dim and dumb in the sun after a long shift last night. It's interesting, I always, of course, just can't believe I can just walk in the door and sit down here. It's like a miracle with everyone. So when I was listening, I suddenly had this sense of my own life, you know, in light of the things you're saying, you know, searching for your head, searching for the flashlight that's just already in use, already in play, of this way that I, like, tip the ship of my life in a search, and then I tip it this way, and I, like, keep tipping it so that this steadiness of all the things you said that are just noticing, the observing and observing, just feel undoable, mm-hmm. You know, and I guess I'm on my road to genius because I'm dimness and the dullness. Can't wait.
I would say already accomplished.
But the daily existence, that's where it is, in the daily interactions with people, moment to moment. Yeah. Like, it's so meaty, it's so cruxy, it's
yeah.
Well, that metaphor you're using about the ship tipping, you know, this down on one side and then up and down on the other side, like a seesaw. This is your particular version of dimness and dullness. You know, that this is the gift that you actually have the capacity to roll like that. Your ship is not steady. Waters are not calm. Right? They're rough waters. So if you didn't have that capacity to tip back and forth, your ship would go down. So this is an example of really using something that seems so challenging. And it is painful to have a tippy ship. Right? It really is. We'd love to have a clear, you know, an ocean liner, right? Yeah, and it makes us sick to our stomachs and mind that. But this is what we get to work. This is what you get to work with, and many of us get. That's what we get. That's how it starts. So, can I be with this tipping fully and see where it leads? And I love that Feldenkrais talks about using your strengths to incorporate the weaknesses. It's not just leading with the weaknesses,
right?
But you have so many strengths. And this other thing that seems like if I could only get rid of it, but actually, it is essential to the completeness of the particular form that you have come into the world as.
And I think it really our weakness calls our strength forward. Uh-huh. You know, I hadn't caught that quite in the same way, but all of your great courage and wisdom is required by all of your stupidity and craziness. And if stupidity and craziness are a resource, then we're all in good shape.
As we were reading that piece aloud, I started to giggle because it reminded me of in my past life. I managed large groups of people, and I read everything I could about management. Mm-hmm. And the newest and greatest stuff would say, you know, be aware of those overconfident people in your group. Mm-hmm. Be aware of the show-offs, and you know. Look a little closer at their work. And it's the ones that think they're dim and dull are the ones that are doing the best work often. So I thought that was interesting that
Dawi
knew this in the 11th century.
Yeah, 11th century.
But it gets repackaged.
Yeah. That's great.
Years ago, there was a movie called The Sixth Sense. Do you remember that movie? And if you haven't seen it, here's a spoiler. This little boy keeps saying, "I see dead people." And it turns out that he actually really does. He sees dead people. And we were listening to the radio one day shortly after we'd seen that movie, and there was a study that was being explained on the radio about competency. And it's very much, I'm sure you know this, anyway, Robin's nodding, that people who think they're competent are often incompetent, and people who think they're incompetent are often competent. So the boy in The Sixth Sense says, "I see dead people, but they don't know they're dead." Right? And so this study was saying incompetent people don't know they're competent, and competent people don't know they're incompetent. So David and I translated this, and we would say this, like, "I see incompetent people, but they don't know they're incompetent." You know, and this quality of integration again, right? It's not about being competent or incompetent. It's about being aware. And as a manager, as a leader, you nudge people into awareness of what they are competent about, and point out their the places where they can grow into competency, and that takes not being fooled by the cover of apparent competency, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think many of us put those clothes on in the morning, not just so we don't look dim and dull.
I believe that article was got some extra press recently. I'm talking about the
current. Oh, yeah. I'm talking about the current administration. Very good example. Wow.
I've been thinking a lot about Six Flags lately, amusement park, just because this is quite a roller coaster. But what's kind of striking me now in this kind of dimness and dullness is when you go there, you know, you wait in line, and maybe about 20 minutes of your whole day is on rides. These rides last like just seconds, you know. And so much of that time, you know, is just in line or after talking about it, maybe watching people are doing that, but all the focus is just waiting, you know, getting on this ride, and all of this, that would just be that, you know, if that's all that you paid attention to, it'd be like 1%, you know, of your life would just be that ride. But really what's happening is all that excitement or anticipation, or all the fear before, maybe the couple arguing in front of you, or the people excited behind you, all the feelings before and after it. And it's just, you know, I'm thinking with this dim and dullness, with this just inclusion of everything, you know, how much you miss out on if all it was that 8-second ride. But you have all that other stuff there. And I just feel so grateful for this practice that you get to open your eyes before, you know, and see all that stuff, that I get to start to see all that stuff now, even when I don't want to see it. Because otherwise, it would be so small. It would be so narrow. So I just feel, I feel that gratefulness, that gratitude for that dim and dullness, which is just opens it all up.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's so easy to focus on some idea. You know, the idea is the ride. That's what we're doing. When all the time, it's everything's an amusement.
Yeah, and the ride for me is waiting. I mean, that's when I'm like on the real ride.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Nervous
already
stuff,
here.
The anticipation of that's the ride for me. Like, that's the scariest part.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm there for adrenaline, it's right there. That's where the adrenaline is.
Yeah, it's great.
And if I'm understanding it correctly, this is really analogous to the way David started the talk, talking about awakening experiences, right? You know, that if we just want those peaks and everything else is just shit.
Yeah.
Right? That there's some way that we miss our whole life.
Entire life.
Yeah. That the shit is exactly the peak experience, the value of it. That in the Zen life, the highs are infrequent and delightful. Make you laugh out loud, like Dawi says. And, we have to look everywhere. It's everywhere.
The comments you made about the, you know, the fact that we're looking for a head when the head is already on, and we're looking for the flashlight when we've got the flashlight in our hand, reminded me of another story, which is about a thief who was determined to steal a diamond from a jeweler. And so he followed this jeweler around, and he tried to locate this diamond he knew the jeweler had. And he searched, he managed to get so close that he could put his hands in the jeweler's pockets. He managed to sneak into the shop. But he didn't find the diamond. And eventually he was just so desperate, he stopped the jeweler and said, "Look, where have you put this diamond?" And he said, well, I've put it somewhere where you would never think to look. And he said, well, where's that? I said, in your own pocket. So this story that really has accompanied me many times when I've been looking for something outside.
Right.
Just to bring it home. Ah, yeah. It's in my pocket.
Right.
That's
right
the last here. Place
right.
I need to look.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely, thank you. Here it is. Well, with that, let's look in our own pockets.